Welcome to Farmed and Dangerous, a long-term memory radio series on the pharmaceutical industry in Canada. Today we examine the link between universities, the federal government, and the drug industry. By the late 1980s, science and technology had moved to the center of federal industrial and economic policy. Since that time, a key area of federal government support for biotechnology has been in the reorganization of public research. While private sector funding for university research has increased significantly in the last 20 years, the majority of funding continues to come from the federal and provincial governments. But government research granting councils have moved towards partnerships with industry. As a result, federal and provincial granting agencies now prioritize research that will keep Canada competitive in a global knowledge-based economy. Our guests are Devlin Koyek, author of The Real Board of Directors, The Construction of Biotechnology Policy in Canada, 1980 to 2002, and Alex Navarre, Director of the Office of Technology Transfer at McGill University.
Since the 80s, the Government of Canada has supported the biotech industry through extension of patents and deregulation. As a result, a handful of pharmaceutical interests now dominate Canadian biotechnology research and development. One area of government support for biotech has been in the reorganization of public research. Here to tell us how it came about and what it means for university-based research is Devlin Koyek, author of The Real Board of Directors, The Construction of Biotechnology Policy in Canada, 1980 to 2002. Hello, Devlin.
Hi.
Hi. Can you tell us, how would you describe the role of universities in Canadian research and development in pharmaceuticals?
Well, it's a relationship that's become a lot tighter since the 1980s. In the 80s, that was under the Mulroney government, there was a big shift between support for the generic pharmaceutical producers and the move towards support for the research-based pharmaceutical industry. They call themselves research-based. What happened was, in the mid-80s, that's when the government started to pursue a free trade agenda. And in the U.S., those pushing for free trade, a large part of the lobby came from the pharmaceutical side of things. They had been frustrated by years of trying to convince national governments to adopt patent legislation favorable to their branded pharmaceuticals. And they were trying to look for something that could happen at the multilateral level. And Canada, with its compulsory licensing legislation, which essentially meant that the government could force a company to license its patented pharmaceutical to a generic manufacturer who could then produce it for a, you know, reasonable rate. And it kept Canada's pharmaceutical prices quite low. But the U.S. industry, and that was led by Ed Pratt, who was the CEO of Pfizer and the special trade representative to Ronald Reagan, and another guy called Gerald Mossinghoff, who had been the commissioner of the Patents and Trade Office for the U.S., but who then became the president of the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association. And they had, and you can see this in the book, I go through a lot of the stuff that's actually documented of what they had been saying, looking to trade agreements where they could push their agenda. And the first target was Canada. And in Canada, of course, you had Mulroney, who was very adamant about pursuing a free trade agenda, neoliberal policies. He's very amenable to this, and basically, in the end, they end up pushing through two very important pieces of legislation that bring Canada's patent legislation into the same boat as U.S. patent legislation, make it essentially the same, and protect the interests of pharmaceutical transnational corporations.
Now, somewhere along the line, there came the melding, the coming together of the notions of science and industry as being one and the same. Can you give us an idea what the background is for that?
Again, this is all part of that free trade push, because what the government had to argue was that free trade was going to bring in new jobs. And what was obvious was that we were going to lose jobs in the manufacturing base and that it would be a sell-off of our natural resources. So you get a lot of these right-wing think tanks promoting this idea of the new economy, the knowledge-based economy. And the government's saying that, well, that's where we're going to create all kinds of jobs. And we're going to do that through what they say is innovation. And innovation to them means basically science that leads to commercial products, industrial products. And in there, they lump biotechnology, information technology, certain chosen industrial sectors. And it was at that same time when there was the move to away from generics to the research-based pharmaceutical companies that you also have the growth of the biotech industry in Canada. Although it was a pretty small industry, it was mostly just startups coming out of university research who got a lot of funding from the federal government. There was a national biotechnology strategy set up in 83. There was all kinds of funding programs from the federal government, particularly, that were supporting biotech companies who were not profitable and who wouldn't have kept afloat without it. And so you get this melding of interest between this biotech industry here in Canada and those people behind it, who happen to be actually some fairly influential figures in some of the bigger companies, and the transnational pharmaceutical interests who were pushing for changes to patent legislation. In order to pass the final bill, Bill C-91, which was the major change to Canadian patent law regarding pharmaceuticals, you did have to have that sell of jobs, but also that you would get some returns for it, because what they were getting was very generous treatment. It was known that pharmaceutical prices were going to rise. So the pharmaceutical industry made a promise. It was a verbal promise that they would reinvest 10% of their profits into research and development in Canada. That's a substantial amount of money, and most of that money ends up going towards biotech industry. And, of course, the biotech industry is mostly just startups out of universities or even public research. And so you've had, at that point, the pharmaceutical TNCs move directly into a position of saying how funds for public research are going to be allocated.
Can you give us an idea how the federal government has promoted universities' dependence on the private sector for research funding?
That, I think, more than any other time happens when the Chrétien government comes into power. The Mulroney government laid the foundation, and then it's the Chrétien government that comes in to build the edifice. And in the first years, it was all policy was really dominated by Martin's deficit-slashing program. You get funds, enormous amounts of funds cut, mostly to transfer payments to the provinces. And, of course, those block transfer payments make up a considerable amount of the money that covers things like tuition costs. So tuitions rise. That was at a time when I was doing my undergraduate program, and I remember those years it was doubling. What's interesting is in the bigger universities, like, say, Queen's, University of Toronto, McGill, the presidents of those universities were not objecting to the cuts. In fact, if you listen close to what they were saying, was that we respect the need to cut our deficit and that block transfer payments are going to be cut, but if you're going to make cuts, cut it to the transfers to our tuition. Cut it out of tuition. And so tuitions rise, and universities then say, well, okay, now we're going to turn to alternative sources of funding, and they look to private sources, they look to private donors, they look to new partnerships, what they call partnerships with industry. And certain universities, like U of T, like Queen's, like McGill, and Université de Montréal, are much more capable of attracting those types of private donors or outside donors than are the smaller universities. And those presidents of the sort of self-styled elite schools felt, okay, those schools who can't source out any more money, they'll become the teaching schools. They'll just teach, whereas the elite schools will become the research schools. So when spending returns in 1996, the same university presidents are lobbying very hard, and it's not just them. They're joined by others, and notably in the pharmaceutical industry, saying that money should be going into research. So instead of putting money back into the block transfer payments, where money would go right into tuitions and lowering tuitions back to the levels where they were when the deficit reduction campaign started, you put the money into research. And it's not just any kind of research. The money goes into a lot of new agencies that are created or restructured to meet government's innovation agenda. And if you look at the innovation agenda, well, they're picking particular industries, and biotech industry, and I include in there the pharmaceutical industry, is one of them. So these new agencies like Genome Canada, like the Canadian Foundation for Innovation, and like the reorganized Canadian Institutes for Health Research have specific mandates to support the biotech industry.
Now, what implications does this have for how health research is being reorganized in public institutions?
Well, it has large implications. They go back certainly to Bill C-91, and when you had the industry saying that it would put in 10% of its earnings towards R&D in Canada, and you had at that time there was a specific program set up called the Medical Research Council Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association of Canada Health Program, And they funded, over 5 years, it was upwards of $200 million, and they funded an enormous amount of public research at universities, at other public research institutions. And also, the president of the Medical Research Council at that time, who was the one who introduced this program, he was involved with a number of new funding initiatives, such as the Canadian Medical Discovery Fund, which is a $175 million venture capital fund for startup companies in the health sector. So here you've got the MRC, you know, our federal granting agency, getting into to venture capital, which is going exclusively towards those areas of health research that are deemed to be commercially viable, that are going to make big bucks. There's no real measure of what that's going to mean for Canada's overall health. That's not the measure they're using. They're using economic measures. And I think that's only grown since then, all kinds of new funds. There's also the new networks, Canadian Genetic Disease Network, which isn't just a network of research. It's also considered sort of one of these centers of incubation, meaning that you incubate startup companies. You incubate a new industry, new industries in the healthcare field. And with the Canadian Genetic Disease Network, it's more in terms of like gene therapy. And the new chair, actually, the new chair of the Canadian Genetic Disease Network is Don Mazankowski, who's the former deputy prime minister under Mulroney. He's also on the board of directors of Power Corp, which is one of the most influential corporations in Canada, which has just recently, it became a major shareholder of BioChem Pharma and now is a major partner in PCHO International, which is a major biotech venture capital fund. Don Mazankowski also was part of the report that was released in Alberta. He was the main chair of the report on the healthcare system in Alberta that was advocating for privatization of healthcare. You'll notice how they're bringing in privatization in order to give people access to new technologies. And a lot of these new technologies, of course, have been developed with public funds in supporting biotech research here at our universities and our public agencies.
Influence of corporate partners and the presence of an industrial strategy taking over the notion of science or pure science must have some implications in terms of the kinds of health research that's going on and also the future of healthcare. How do you interpret the link between government, pharmaceutical industry, and universities in terms of healthcare in the future?
Well, what's important to remember there is when you look at the pharmaceutical industry, anything basically commercial happening in healthcare, it's dominated by a small number of corporations. I think it's about 10 pharmaceutical companies now have, well, 50% of all pharmaceutical sales, and they dominate the research and development. So if you're trying to start up health research that feeds into biotech, or if you're starting to set up a health sciences industry in Canada, what you're doing really is feeding into a larger health industry that is dominated by a small number of pharmaceutical companies. Because if you're, say, at McGill University and you want to develop a product, you get a patent, you go to the commercialization step, and that is essentially you look for a way to license it to a company. And there are only so many players out there, and the bigger players that are going to take that to the commercialization stage are a small number of transnational corporations. So whatever you're developing has to meet the commercial objectives of these large transnational corporations. And they certainly don't have what I would consider the health interests of Canadians at heart. What they draw up in their boardrooms is not what Canadian society would draw up as the way to achieving health care. It has so many implications across the board. The development of expensive technologies that can really undermine our health care system. If you look at the statements that are being made by various ministers or bureaucrats when it comes to potentially opening up the healthcare system to a two-tier system or making certain things available. It's always justified on, you know, making technologies available. Well, why are we pursuing technologies that can't be covered under a equitable healthcare system?
There's a current push on at McGill and other leading universities across Canada towards genomics and proteomics. Is there anything you can tell us about the forces in government policy that influence this push?
Actually, before I get into that,
okay,
I'd also like to say that one of the major implications, too, is that we aren't pursuing other areas of research that would be much more in line with our overall, Canadian society's overall objectives in terms of healthcare. And those, of course, are looking at health through a more holistic way, looking at those factors that are detrimental to our health, looking at precautionary means to deal with healthcare. Those things fall by the wayside, and everything that we're pursuing in health research has to follow in line with our industrial strategy, which is basically to support biotechnology and the growth of the pharmaceutical industry. But that has a lot to do with, I think, the reason why universities are moving more towards genomics and proteomics. The people who sit on the top of a lot of the government agencies, federal agencies particularly, that's at least where I've studied, and it's the same thing in most provinces. But at least in the federal level, people who sit on the top of these agencies are those who have been working in these fields, are those who have developed and nurtured connections with pharmaceutical industry. I mean, if you think of the president of the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, Alan Bernstein, he was one of the first, after the, you know, the patent legislation came in, the R&D money started coming in from the pharmaceutical industry, he was one of the first big beneficiaries of that money when he was with the Lunenfeld Hospital in Toronto, and his study of genetic approaches to disease. In my book, you'll see that the cast of characters is really quite long, those characters who have one foot on the industry side and one foot in the public research side. Also, with the restructuring of funding for public education, for universities, how it's moved towards more of these like government-directed, federal government-directed research programs. You have Genome Canada, which is a new type of granting agency, which has millions and millions of dollars, and which makes the board of directors is the one who has the final say of who gets money and who doesn't. If you look at the board of directors, they're all from, almost entirely from the biotech industry, and the scientific advisors who are supposed to judge what science is credible, none of them are Canadian, so it's hard for me to understand how they could assess the health needs of Canadians and then make decisions about what kind of research should be funded. And that's the kind of stuff that's really shaping the direction of health research at our universities, and it's tragic.
So it sounds like what you're saying is this reorganization of public research and these new technologies are leading towards a kind of medicine that will be provided to people who can afford them.
Yeah, well, that's essentially what it's all about. I don't think there's any question that if a government is intent on pursuing, despite the objections of its citizens, biotechnology, that it's playing into a very dangerous game, and that's aligning its interests with that industry's interests. And in the end, they're about, you know, making money. And the way to make money is to have these expensive technologies and base it on like personalized treatment and things like, imagine, a lot of these corporate executives are saying what they want to do is everybody will have the ability to put their genomes on a chip, and then you'll be able to read that chip and we'll be able to say, well, what kind of, you know, treatments you need. It's cradle-to-grave stuff, so it's addiction. It increased tenfold from what we already have.
Is there anything else you'd like to mention before we let you go?
Well, one of the things those people who I work with are really intent on doing is trying to counter the push towards patents on living organisms, and that's a crucial sort of piece of the puzzle in supporting the biotech industry and catering to the pharmaceutical industry's interests. And it has a lot of repercussions, not only just ethically, but it has a lot of repercussions for what kind of alternatives people are able to pursue. I think that debate really needs to become much more public. People really need to learn much more about what's happening. In the throne speech yesterday, it was quite clear. They said explicitly that they wanted to pursue patents in the area of life forms. So this is something that's coming up real soon, and I think it's something we all need to be aware of.
We've been speaking with Devlin Kuyak, who's the author of The Real Board of Directors, The Construction of Biotechnology Policy in Canada, 1980 to 2002. And for a closer look at how transnational corporations are reorganizing their push for a biotech future, a report entitled Galloping Gene Giants, prepared by Tony Clark and Brenda Inouye and published by the Polaris Institute, is available for a nominal price on the Polaris Institute website at www.polarisinstitute.org. That's www.polarisinstitute.org.
Devlin Kuyak's book, The Real Board of Directors, is available on the Ramshorn website at www.ramshorn.bc.ca. That's www.ramshorn.bc.ca.
Well, I don't know if you read about this, but the law of gravity expires soon. And Congress is working overtime on new gravity legislation that says you can stay on the Earth, that's okay, but if you haven't found a job after 2 years, you float away. Anyway, here's a song about a lot of other stories in today's newspaper that you may not have read about.
They installed a condom dispenser at the Vatican. Yasser Arafat said he'd never wear that hat again. Germans gave every Holocaust survivor a Mercedes-Benz, and the Tutsis and the Hutus made amends.
Hell froze over today,
and I made good on several debts I never thought I'd have to pay. They discovered Jimmy Hoffa in a houseboat on Lake Erie.
Someone proved conclusively the single bullet theory.
Was wrong. Woody Allen walked hand in hand with Louis Farrakhan. Face the Nation had Cindy Crawford and Bo Derek on. The Earth fell out of its orbit and careened into the sun. Bob Dole ran for president and won.
Hell froze over today,
and I made good on several debts I never thought I'd have to pay. They awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor to Timothy Leary.
Someone proved conclusively the single bullet theory was wrong.
Uncle Sam made reparations for repressions great and small by creating a society with liberty and dignity and equal opportunity and justice for all. Well, that Earth Goddess program on Channel 3 went national. Iran and Iraq came one country called Irrational. Every commuter in Greater Los Angeles learned how to ride the bus.
And the rich folks said, please tax the shit out of us. Hell froze over today,
and I made good on several debts I never thought I'd have to pay. They served something tasty and nutritious in a high school cafeteria.
Someone proved conclusively the single bullet theory.
Yeah.
Someone proved conclusively the single bullet theory was wrong.
When the liberals cut transfer payments to the provinces to get their fiscal house in order, top-notch research universities had to raise their own money to stay competitive. One way to do this was to get funding from major corporate donors, or as they're often called, partners. Another way was to commercialize their research, essentially renting it out through contracts with corporations. Educational and research institutions in Canada now play a critical role in promoting technology development by actively engaging in the commercialization of knowledge. For this reason, most research universities now have their own technology transfer companies or offices, responsible for filing patents, licensing out university research, and supporting spin-off companies, with the full support of the federal government. These days, the pharmaceutical industry wants to create cradle-to-grave drug therapies based on the genetic identification of potential diseases among humans. The goal is to have all genetic information in a database and to predict the medications people will need to take based on their genomes. This shift to medicines based on individual genetic data is consistent with the government's innovation agenda and is predicted to take drug sales to new heights.
In August of 2002, there was an announcement by the Quebec provincial government that $100 million approximately will be invested to subsidize biotech research. And McGill, of course, is an important player in the biotech sector. And in fact, there's a new center for genomics and proteomics presently going up on Dr. Penfield Avenue here in Montreal, said to be or touted as one of the top 10 genomics and proteomics research centers in the world. Our guest is Dr. Alex Navarre, the director of the Office of Technology Transfer at McGill University. How are you this afternoon?
Good, thank you. Thank you very much for having the opportunity to talk to you.
For general consumption, could you just tell us what is proteomics and what is genomics?
Well, essentially, genomics is the first level of the science of studying the human and plant genomes. You have a certain number of genomes, I mean a great number of genomes in you and in all of us, and whether plants or humans or animals, and the idea is to study the effect of these genomes and to understand better their role in the fabric of the living species. For proteomics, it's going one step further, and that is to better understand the subcomponents of the genomes, and that is the study of the proteins that are making up the genomic chains.
Now, what does technology transfer mean in the context of biomedical research?
Technology transfer as a whole is called technology because it is applied to the scientific area, but if you look at it from a broader perspective, it is knowledge transfer. So essentially it is to take what inventions or know-how and knowledge exists in laboratories that could be translated or in any particular or in any particular area of a university and could be used or translated into the general use in the economy. And this is what technology transfer really means. It is to take some science or some creations and to bring them to the people that can use them and introduce them into the products we use on a daily basis, whether it is new drugs, whether it is new therapies, whether it is new diagnostic, this is in the medical area, or it can also apply to the arts, or it can be applied to the engineering sciences.
But from the point of view of medicine, when you say to the people who can use them, you're actually possibly referring to the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, I'm referring really to pharmaceutical industry so that we can produce up-to-date drugs that can be used by patients.
But is there an argument for saying that technology transfer actually refers to the creation of patents?
The most likely way we transfer the knowledge is through patents. But it is not the exclusive way. In some instances, we have transferred know-how to the private sector, and the private sector is in need of this knowledge. And a patent is composed of a real invention, and it is also accompanied by some services that are provided by the people that have produced this intellectual property or this patent or this invention, and these people are helping to make sure that those who are receivers of this technology can use it properly.
Okay, I'm interested in the word invention in the sense that there are those who argue that using a human genetic material or claiming to own a certain aspect of human genetic composition should not be claimed as an invention. For example, if you look at in India, where there are certain kinds of genetic material that are unique and unobtainable in many parts of the world, the companies go in and offer lots of money for this material in order to develop therapies and at the same time establish patents on these processes. And there is an argument against the notion that it is truly an invention.
Well, I can tell you that in Canada, and it may not apply to India, but in Canada it is not legal to sell human tissues. So human tissues can be used, can be transferred to other entities to be studied, but they cannot be sold.
What about the data? For example, the data from Quebec founder populations that has been used or adapted in various ways for pharmaceutical research. That's not genetic material, but at the same time, it is data. It is information having to do with people's lifespans, their health problems, beginning with a small population confined to a certain geographical area. Is any of that Quebec founder population data being used in McGill research?
I can tell you that the researchers are going to use what is essential to their research. So using data that has been, let me say, randomized and that is not referring to any individual, so that any of the individual cannot be recognized in the sample, is just using data, and there are numerous data and databases that exist, and whether it is in the medical field, in the financial field, in the economic field, and statisticians make a living messaging data to get some new results. It is certainly very important to the medical science to understand better, for instance, the effects of some drugs on humans or some behaviors on humans, and any collection and larger collection of data that can isolate some trends or some approaches or some effects will certainly help the science and the design of better drugs, whether it is pharmaceutical companies or whether it is by scientists that want to improve the level of treatment that we can provide to the population.
There was a French study where they found that between 1,400 and 1,500 new variants of older drugs were redundant. Now, I understand that you're moving in a new direction with gene therapy and proteomics, but at the same time, how market-oriented is this research?
Well, I can tell you that research is very seldom market-oriented. When you say a market orientation, you are automatically thinking of improvements on a particular invention. An invention, by essence, is an accident. It is a correlation of events that trigger the human mind to think of a hypothesis, and then you have to prove or disprove that particular hypothesis, and if you prove it, you call it an invention because it worked, it is useful, it is novel, and you have an invention. But McGill is really at the stage where we work on concepts, we work on research, we are at the forefront of science. And before we talk about marketing and commercialization, it takes probably 10 years to get there. So, you know, before you get into what we call the clinical trials, 1, 2, 3, the various stages to prove a drug, it takes a long time. And by this time, I can tell you, McGill is totally out of it. In fact, we leave it at the very early stage of what could be conceived as a marketing path. And at that point, there are private interests that come in, decide to pour in millions of dollars to just take a risk whether it's going to work or not.
You're saying the private interests come in later, that this is pure science?
We are at the rather pure science stage. This is the research. This is where we are trying to identify some new potentials, and we are not at the stage where we are developing drugs. McGill is absolutely not in that particular area. It is in the area of trying to identify new approaches and try to identify new diagnostics for diseases or new approaches to treatment of diseases. But it is working at a level that is far, far before any commercialization can really be talked about as such. We are really at the concept and sometimes the early proof of a concept stage.
But you do, of course, acknowledge that a lot of your research is being funded by the pharmaceutical industry.
Absolutely, because essentially the pharmaceutical industry has to find new targets, new potential avenues to secure its future. I mean, if the pharmaceutical industry was living on its particular portfolio of current drugs, they would not have anything new to propose for the next generation of drugs, and they would not do very well. But you know that to develop a drug, it costs about $500 million, and it takes about 10 years.
But the dean of your Faculty of Medicine mentions in a statement released around the new Montreal Genomics and Proteomics Center that McGill needs to remain at the forefront of the genomics and proteomics research race. In fact, he refers to the race a couple of times. The race is on to conduct studies of genes and chromosomes using information technology and robotics. How would you characterize this race?
Well, the race is in terms of scientific race. There are a given number, I think it was around 140,000 genes, and there are a multiple of that number in terms of proteins that form the science of proteomics. So the characterization of each of those and the analysis of their potential activity in terms of curing a multitude or a number of diseases is a tremendous task. And obviously every scientist is out there trying to generate as many results as possible. I mean, everybody probably in some areas or in his respective area or her respective area trying to hope to be able to identify the cure that will say, cure AIDS or cure cancer in a better way, in a way that is more convivial. And that is the essence of the work of these very dedicated scientists.
This is pure science, and that any discoveries or any drug developments are down the road. But I get the impression that any number of McGill professors are either directly employed or indirectly employed by pharmaceutical companies in the areas of proteomics and other areas at this very moment, and that the acceleration of commercialization of these discoveries is a crucial part of the agenda.
Your first statement is absolutely right. There are researchers need to be funded for a very expensive piece of research they are carrying. In whatever medical field they are, it is very expensive. And the granting councils help them to a certain extent. Some actually take the view that they have enough money and they are self-sufficient with the granting agencies, but others are more ambitious and they want to do more in terms of science, and they will go where they can get more funding to do that science. On the other hand, you have the industry community, who also has researchers, by the way, also have their own research programs, and their researchers are talking to the university researchers, and they emulate each other. And these researchers from industry, or these industries, want to secure the future of their pipeline of new products, if I may say. And by doing that, they seek alliances with prominent researchers so that they can have a chance to tap into the inventions that they may do, or what discoveries they may have, and have a first crack at, say, being eventually on the market 10 years down the road, but taking, you know, it's like in the mining industry, you stake your territory. Well, this is what it is. So industries have this approach that they want to establish some relationships which we call partnerships or alliances with researchers so that they can have a first look at what they have. And if it fits with their vision of the future, with their core business, then they will decide to invest later on, and they generally do what we call here a license, and they have a license with the university to be able to pursue the work on potential avenues that eventually will lead to drugs or diagnostics or whatever the subject.
I see that on the McGill website, there's news of a collaborative agreement with a privately owned drug company called Caprion Pharmaceuticals.
Yes, indeed.
In which the agreement is set up in such a way that Caprion will have access to certain intellectual property developed under this collaboration, and will have, at the outset and before anything is developed, will have exclusive rights to license any proteomic technologies developed. So,
mm-hmm.
In a sense, and in fact, the researcher in question is not only a full professor at McGill University, but he's also Caprion's chief scientific officer for proteomics. Could you tell us how many McGill professors are directly employed by pharmaceutical companies?
McGill researchers are not formally employed by pharmaceutical companies. They are employed by McGill. But McGill is flexible enough, like most North American universities, to allow its researchers to also have some activities at a private company. And these companies, therefore, sign some partnership agreements with the university, with us, and in these partnership agreements, they agree to finance equipment, to finance research, in return of which, the university gives them what I was telling you a little bit before, some rights, first right of looking at the portfolio of inventions that comes out of their financed research. So in other words, their dollars are invested, and in return, although we own the intellectual property, we tell them you can use it, provided we make some further agreements, but you can use it by way of licenses, and therefore they have a first look and a first crack at licensing some of these inventions from the financed research that they have financed themselves.
Now, the $100 million announced in August seems to come from a broad base of federal and provincial monies, private business. Can you give us an idea what proportion of the money invested in biomedical research at McGill comes from private interests?
Oh, that's a very difficult question to answer to you, but I would say as a rough cut, contractual research at the university is relatively small in terms of numbers and dollar value. It is of the order of 10 to 15% of the overall research expenses at McGill. So in the biomedical area, I wouldn't think that it is much different. Now, what you have to dissociate is probably research per se and clinical trials, because in our affiliated hospitals, we also do a number of clinical trials. And that is a little bit different. I wouldn't consider that as pure research. I would consider that as trying to prove the activity of some compounds and trying to see the effect of whether it is on animals or on humans. And so if you take away this financing, you are down to something like probably 5%, 8% of the overall university research. So I think it is a very minimal percentage. This is at McGill. McGill is one of the lowest in Canada in terms of these percentages because it's doing so well with respect to its grants from the granting councils, whether provincial or federal. So if you look at other universities, whether it is in Quebec or other universities in Canada, the percentages will be higher.
How many patents are derived from this research going on at McGill?
Well, that all depends if you take them on a yearly basis, if you take them as a whole, but on a yearly basis, you may get probably in the neighborhood of 20 at the most, 20 patents a year, roughly. And I would say this depends very much on the sources of funds, because the university is trying to encourage the researchers so that these inventions are indeed being protected and not arrive in the public domain, and then nobody will touch them and nobody will use them because they don't have any monopoly associated to them. So the companies will not want to invest in something that is not protected. But I would say we are averagely, we do about 30, or we manage to have about 30 roughly patents a year.
Okay. And how important are royalties from patents for the university itself?
I would say they are important, but they are not important right now in terms of absolute value. If I look at our revenues last year from royalties, they were turning around $1.5 million. When you look at the cost of running a university, this is a drop in a big bucket. We hopefully will increase with time the revenues from these licenses because our program is relatively young, and if we look at much more mature programs in the U.S., and we can see also a progression in ours, you can see that these numbers will increase. But they will not likely increase unless you hit a blockbuster, but otherwise they will not likely increase to become significant in the revenues of the university.
Now, of course, genomics research is claimed to be revolutionizing medicine, that it will greatly improve scientific approaches to disease, diagnosis, treatment, and human health. How will it do that?
Well, I think if we all knew that, we probably wouldn't have any challenge. Each time you have a new scientific frontier that is being pushed, you have a lot of speculation and a lot of enthusiasm that is coming out of it, and this is perfectly legitimate. The question is, the scientists are there to try to make it happen. We all realize that this finer understanding of the fabric of the cells in the human body and their inner mechanistic effect is something that will maybe help us better design more appropriate personalized drugs, whatever. There are different theories about that, but at the end, what I think is important is to be in better health, to have a population that can live longer and can enjoy life better. And this is all about what the scientists are trying to do, apart from their personal interests, to push the science to its limit.
I think I've more or less come to the end of my questions, Dr. Navarre, and I thank you very much for your patience and your willingness to answer my questions. Is there anything you'd like to say before I let you go?
Well, Judith, I do appreciate very much. I hope that we're going to have a lot more scientists coming out of interviews like this, and people interested also in pushing the science, especially in the medical, biomedical areas that are so exciting, and there is so much to do in the future in those areas.
Alex Navar, director of the Office of Technology Transfer at McGill University, spoke to us from his office in Montreal.
Using genomics to make new drugs is helping leading pharmaceutical corporations deal with potential financial losses due to expiring patents on their top-selling products, particularly on blockbuster drugs that make more than $1 billion U.S. in sales per year. Genomics, they say, provides more potential for drug discovery over previous methods, which use natural and/or synthetic chemicals. The leading pharmaceutical corporations are the main drivers of the pharmaceutical biotech industry. Corporations like Pfizer, Hoffmann La Roche, Aventis, and Eli Lilly have the money and the expertise to bring genetically engineered drugs to market, and they have invested billions in biotech research and development for more than 20 years. Up to half of a pharmaceutical corporation's annual billion-dollar-plus R&D budget could be spent on biotech. What's wrong with that? First, the cost of developing genetically engineered drugs is high, but the industry is not paying for it on its own. As Devlin Kuyek points out, public money is flowing to the biotech industry through government subsidies to universities and to government bodies like the Biotechnology Research Institute, which are partnered, as they say, with industry. As universities are drawn into these partnerships due to cuts in government funding, the biotech industry has become dependent on publicly funded research for technological developments. And these university-industry collaborations do not come without conflicts of interest and threats to academic freedom and research integrity. As the multinational drug industry propels itself and the general public into genetic technologies as a source of new medicines, the issue of drug safety must inevitably come up. What are the health implications of using genetically engineered drugs, and how necessary are they? For more information on the involvement of multinational pharmaceutical corporations in biotechnology, check out two articles by Brenda Inouye, that's Inouye, I-N-O-U-Y-E, of the Polaris Institute. The first is entitled The Genetically Engineered Drug Industry, and it's available on the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives website at www.policyalternatives.ca. That's www.policyalternatives.ca. The second, Unpacking the Pharma Biotech Engines, is available on the Polaris Institute website at www.polarisinstitute.org. That's www.polarisinstitute.org.
Once again, Devlin Kuyak's book, The Real Board of Directors, The Construction of Biotechnology Policy in Canada, 1980 to 2002, is available on the Ramshorn website at www.ramshorn.bc.ca. That's www.ramshorn.bc.ca. Next week, Farms and Dangers focuses on ethical issues related to drug company-sponsored research, both in Canada and abroad. Our guest will be Dr. Nancy Olivieri, medical researcher at the University of Toronto, who fought the good fight against a big pharmaceutical company and lived to tell the tale. And Dr. Peter Lurie of the Public Citizens Health Research Group, who tells some chilling stories of drug company-sponsored research in third world countries, where patients get salt water instead of medicine. Our thanks to Devlin Kuyak, Alex Navar, Community News Coordinator Gretchen King, and Technician Rhea Freeman. Farmed and Dangerous is produced by Judith Toib. I'm Mark Bendit for Long-Term Memory Radio.